and thanks for turning on the Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, an interview with Bill Browder, once the largest foreign investor in Russia, now a tireless crusader for justice for his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who died in a Russian prison cell.
In the end, he got sick from the torture. They denied him medical attention, and he died. It's about as open and shut as you can get, and there's a ream, thousands of pages of documents to prove it.
We talk with Evgeny Morozov, the noted author and blogger who's written a provocative new book. He says the internet and social networking sites are not the great forces for freedom and democracy some might think.
The reason why the KGB wants you to join Facebook is because it allows them to, first of all, learn more about you from afar.
But first, a story about the literal burden some children in Afghanistan's capital are forced to bear. Charles Recknagel has the story.
Early each morning, the young children of the neighborhood of Akibi Silo emerge from their homes on a hillside near the center of Kabul. But they don't head off to class. They go to fetch water, over and over, until long after the school day is done.
My name is Hasina. The water tap is very far away. We get water there and sell it to our neighbors for 10 Afghanis.
My name is Nasratullah. I went to school until second grade, but I stopped because we have no one to look after our household and buy groceries.
These children are dealing with the same problem. Their neighborhood has had no running water for years, so they must go to a tap at the base of the hill and haul the water back up the steep slopes themselves. Some of the kids carry water just to meet their family's own needs, but many do it because they need the few Afghanis they can earn for each bucket, like this young boy named Mirwais.
Each trip takes 2 to 2.5 hours. We bring water for our neighbors. Each bucket costs 10 Afghanis. If we say 15 or 20, they go get the water themselves.
The public tap they use runs for only a few hours every 2 days. When it's not working, the water carriers go door to door, asking for water in the neighborhoods that have it. At best, Mirwais, working with a donkey, can make about 200 Afghanis a day, or about $4. It's only enough to buy bread for his family, but it's a source of income they can't live without.
We have nobody at home who earns money. Everything is very expensive. Rice, wood for heating. Because of that, I left school and I started working with my donkey.
The residents of Akibi Silo have complained to Kabul city officials about their water problems for years. A new water management office for the city was created recently, but few people know how to contact it, and corruption and bureaucracy in the city government are notorious. Meanwhile, the residents are growing angry with living without the most basic resources in their country's capital. One customer, a man named Zaudin, buys water from the children because he's too ill to carry it himself.
Everybody here has a difficult situation because of the lack of drinking water. Look how high up on the mountain we are and how far our kids have to go to get water.
For now, this neighborhood remains dependent on the children who carry water. And while their families remain poor, Mirwais and the other children depend on this draining work to make a living.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast. The United Nations has just launched an investigation into the high-profile death of Russian lawyer Sergei Magnitsky. Magnitsky's boss, Bill Browder, once the biggest foreign investor in Russia's stock market, says his attorney was murdered by corrupt Russian officials for exposing massive fraud worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Browder, now banned from Russia, is leading a campaign to enact international sanctions against 60 Russian officials he alleges were involved with Magnitsky's death. Browder visited RFERL's headquarters in Prague and sat down with correspondents Gregory Pfeiffer and Irina Lagunina.
You've said that essentially the Russian authorities were holding Sergei Magnitsky hostage and essentially killed him. What is your proof of that?
Well, the first proof is that they arrested him for a crime that he couldn't have possibly committed. They said that he was a director of a company that didn't pay taxes when he wasn't a director of that company, and that company did pay taxes. secondly, he was arrested by the same officials, the same officers that he had testified against for being involved in a major tax rebate fraud. And those officials then had him arrested after he testified against them. He was then subjected to unbelievable, undescribable torture in prison for having testified against those officers. And in the end, he got sick from the torture. They denied him medical attention, and he died. It's about as open and shut as you can get, and there's a ream, thousands of pages of documents to prove it. It's about the most provable case of false arrest and torture that you can have, because the documents are just so unbelievably compelling, which is what's inspired all these politicians from around the world to do something about this, because it's just such a black and white case.
So you actually singled out this list of 80 officials.
60, actually.
60 officials that were involved in Magnitsky's case. How would you describe this list? Is this like a state within the state, or is this a characteristic of the power in Russia right now?
The list was constructed because, interestingly, Russia has this crazy bureaucratic process, which everybody who does terrible things writes it down on a piece of paper. So as a result of true torture being done to Sergei, it was all documented. And so we were able to get the names, get the names of the judge who rejected Sergei's request for medical attention, get the names of the investigators who put forth false evidence to have him incarcerated, get the names of the prison doctor who refused him medical attention, et cetera, et cetera. So we were able to put this whole list together based on the bureaucracy's own set of documentation. In terms of your question, is this just a rogue gang or not? Well, the more that we've been public about this case, the more people who have been victimized have come forward and said, you know, it's interesting that your list of 60, these seven people did this terrible things to us or to our family or to our husband or our father. And we've been approached, I think, on 10 different occasions by people who've been victimized by the same group. And as the more people that approach us, the more it seems as if this is the criminal brigade that works for the top brass of Russia. It's not a rogue gang. This is a gang that's fully authorized to go about illegal, fraudulent business and to ruin lives and to kill people.
There's an ongoing debate that there's a split between authoritarian Vladimir Putin and would-be liberal Dmitry Medvedev, and it's just a matter of time until Medvedev seizes the reins of power more than 2 years into his presidency. Do you agree with this argument at all? Do you think maybe this is a way of distracting outsiders of the West from what's actually going on? How do you read this?
I just look at the facts. I tend not to look at statements that are made, and I just look at the facts. And the facts are pretty straightforward. The facts are, in our case anyways, that Medvedev called for an investigation a week after Sergei Magnitsky was tortured to death, and he called for an investigation into his death. And in the year since he called that investigation, the people who tortured Sergei were promoted. They were awarded state honors, and not a single and then they blamed Sergei for the crime that he had uncovered that they had committed. It makes a mockery of this man. Now, of course, who wouldn't love to see his anti-legal nihilism campaign bear fruit? But I mean, the facts speak for themselves, and unless he wants to put his foot down and show that he's truly the man in charge, we can only conclude that he's essentially not.
You've warned Western companies not to invest in Russia. Can I ask you why? And can I also ask you to comment on a very recent deal between BP and Rosneft?
Why shouldn't Western companies invest in Russia? And the answer is because it's completely sort of Russian roulette capitalism. It's entirely possible at any point in time to literally have your head blown off doing business in Russia. And my own case is a prime example. But my own case is just the tip of the iceberg. And for every case like mine that you know about, there are 20 other people just like me, who are suffering in silence. And sometimes they're not suffering so silently. I get contacted by these people all the time, but it's just heartbreaking, the kind of misery that people go through. This is not a business risk like any other business risk. This is true Russian roulette type risk. As far as BP and Rosneft goes, I have to say I know that story very well because I know all the players and I've known them, and it's amazing to me that BP is in such a desperate situation that they would have had to resort to going back to this to this sort of abusive relationship for the third time. And they got ripped off when they invested in Sedanco in back in 1997. They got completely humiliated in their fight with the majority shareholders of TNK-BP in ways that we don't even know about. I mean, what we know about is just it's just the stuff that got public. And now they're going back for a third round. You know, hurt once, shame on them. Hurt twice, shame on you. Hurt three times, shame on I don't know who.
Correspondents Irina Lagunina and Gregory Pfeiffer speaking with investor Bill Browder. The full interview is available on our website, rfurl.org. Now, many argue that the Internet is transforming the world, boosting freedom and democracy by allowing information to flow more freely than ever before. But Evgeny Morozov says that along with the good comes a world of bad. He makes that point in a new book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. Morozov warns that authoritarian regimes like Russia, China, and Iran have adapted quickly to devise new ways to track and neutralize Internet activism. Correspondent Robert Coulson spoke by phone with Morozov in London.
At the risk of asking you to sort of tweet your book, could you just, in a soundbite or so, give us what you think is the most important thing you want readers to take away from it?
Many of the assumptions that policymakers, intellectuals, and journalists operate with when they think about the political power of the Internet are naive and need to be updated.
One of your chapters is called, provocatively, Why the KGB Wants You to Join Facebook. Could you tell us, why does the KGB want us to join Facebook?
Part of the argument I'm making in the book is that authoritarian governments have immensely benefited from the web, and I point to three features. One of them is propaganda, one of them is new ways of censorship, and one of them is increased surveillance, more sophisticated surveillance. The reason why the KGB wants you to join Facebook is because it allows them to, first of all, learn more about you from afar. I mean, they don't have to come and interrogate you, and obviously you sell this close quite a bit. It allows them to identify certain social graphs and social connections between activists, because many of these relationships are now self-disclosed by activists. Joining various groups, you can actually go and see which causes are more popular than others. But also, it's possible to start identifying trends on the macro level, where you can actually go and using data posted to social media sites, not just Facebook. I'm talking here more broadly about blogs and about tweets. You can actually start identifying which way social sentiment in the country is moving. And that way you may get ahead of, the actual real developments.
To be honest, I left your book sort of uncertain about where you stand on whether or not democracy promotion is a possible or worthwhile goal in general, or one that Western governments and NGOs should be pursuing regarding authoritarian regimes. Do you think that it is? And if so, what informational communications component should it have?
I mean, I don't think actually it's that ambiguous in the book. I do several times mention, that what I want is just to find a better way to use the Internet for promoting democracy. So, to me, it sounds like a very explicit endorsement of promoting democracy, to begin with. So to answer it even more directly, yes, I do think that, that there are definitely things that foundations and governments can do to promote, if not the banner of democracy, then at least the banner of democratic values, freedom of expression, and human rights. So in no way do I want to reject and kind of completely stop that work.
You talk a little bit in the book about your own evolution from a democracy activist in the post-Soviet space to an enthusiast about the revolutionary power. You even confessed that you talked about Twitter revolutions and things like that yourself, to your sort of cyber realist stance now. If you were an activist now in an authoritarian country, what, if anything, would you be doing on the internet, and what would your internet activism strategy be?
Yeah, but you know, to me, this question doesn't make any sense asked in the abstract. You know, so all authoritarian countries are different. You know, so if I were in Russia, I would be doing things which are completely different from what I would be doing in Iran. I mean, to me, the assumption that you know, authoritarian countries are alike, and you know, all of them need more or less similar things, which you can then reduce to the concept of internet freedom. Is just, you know, simplistic, and it's probably counterproductive.
Let me ask it in a more specific and concrete way. If you were, for example, an activist in Belarus right now, your home country, would you have a Facebook account? Would you have a Twitter account yourself, personally?
If I were, you know, someone who is mobilizing people to participate and, you know, and protest and whatnot and highlighting the work of the opposition, I think, yes, you know, again, I may be careful about who I select as my friends. Maybe I wouldn't add anyone actually as my friend. WikiLeaks on Twitter doesn't follow anyone except for one backup account, right? I think for a good reason that if it starts following people, those people may actually get into trouble, as we also have seen now with Department of Justice going after them. You know, I do think that in some cases it helps. Social media definitely helps to mobilize and to bring attention to issues. It has to be balanced with the security concerns. It has to be balanced with, you know, just being smart about what you do on Facebook.
That was correspondent Robert Colson's interview with Evgeny Morozov. Again, the full interview is available on our website, rfrl.org. And finally, when life hands you lemons, make lemon vodka. That seems to be the principle behind the Kremlin's full-court promotion of their once-secret, still-sultry agent, Anna Chapman. The FBI arrested her last year for her role in a Moscow spy ring and later deported her as part of a prisoner swap. Chapman's brief career as a spy apparently didn't yield much in the way of actual intelligence, but that hasn't kept her from launching a multifaceted new chapter of her life back home as a banking expert, political agitator, and now a TV star. Correspondent Daisy Sindelar reports.
The worlds of spying and showbiz would seem to be mutually exclusive, but Anna Chapman, Russia's flame-haired former agent, is making a career of both.
Меня зовут Анна Чапман.
The 28-year-old Chapman, part of a post-Soviet spy ring deported last year from the U.S., made her Russian television debut last week. The program, Secrets of the World with Anna Chapman, claims to draw on her talents as a spy in tackling real-life mysteries. The show is the crowning achievement in a season that has seen the alluring Chapman rise from a discredited former spy to a Kremlin pinup girl. In just a few short months, the former Anna Kuchenko has taken on a post at a Moscow bank, posed for a Russian men's magazine, and starred in a New Year's parody of 17 Moments of Spring, a revered 1970s television series about a Soviet foreign agent.
Анна Чапман и Максим Исаев не виделись много лет, потому что в Америке никогда не показывают 17 мгновений весны.
Chapman has added a political dimension to her career as well. She is seen as enjoying friendly relations with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, himself a former spy. And last month, she joined the leadership of Young Guard, the youth wing of Putin's powerful United Russia Party. At a Young Guard Congress, she called on fellow members to change the country by changing ourselves and to simply be happy.
Ребята, давайте начнем менять страну с самих себя. Будьте счастливы.
Not everyone is happy, however. Music critic Artyom Troitsky, who has emerged as a pointed observer of Russia's current political regime, says Chapman deserves neither jobs nor celebrity after failing to turn up any information of substance during her brief and undistinguished career as a spy.
Well, I wouldn't say she's especially popular. I think that most people have a very ironic opinion of her. It is perceived that she is like a new favorite toy of Vladimir Putin or something. So because of that, you know, all kinds of people, you know, the media people, the bankers, they try to shower her with all kinds of favors, you know, because they think that she's Putin's toy girl.
Other agents in Chapman's spy ring have benefited from similar largesse, taking on posts at energy giants like Transneft and Rosneft. None of them, however, have received their own television show. Edward Lucas, a senior editor at The Economist who is currently writing a book on Russian spies, says the Kremlin remains proud of the country's spy heritage. He says Putin and others may be eager to show the U.S. that what Chapman failed to deliver in intelligence, she more than makes up for in charm.
The Kremlin wants to push back on this and to say, you know what, we have this really hot spy chick, and we bet, you know, your spies aren't as glamorous as she is. And I think in a way it's quite good for the image of Russia, the idea that you have this, you know, multilingual, talented, cosmopolitan, reasonably good-looking, versatile woman as a representative of the new Russia.
The smartest step for Russia, Lucas says, is to put Chapman and her charms to work on remaking the national image. And that seems to be just what the Kremlin is doing.
And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye.